Hi, Spring fans. Welcome to a beautiful podcast. I'm your host, Spring Developer Advocate Josh Long, and this show is all about the real heroes behind Spring and its ecosystem. Hi, Spring fans. Welcome to another installment of a beautiful podcast. This week, I'm in positively gorgeous New York City ahead of the Kafka Summit next week, where I'll join Pivotal Senior Vice President James Waters and Confluent Developer Advocate Chief Tim Berglund for a talk on using Kafka and Spring together. Talk about a bucket list performance option for me, right, or opportunity for me. I love both of these gents. I also love visiting New York City because it gives me a chance to visit with New York City-based Spring team legends like Dr. Mark Pollack and Rosin Stoyanchev. New York City marks the beginning of a three-week whirlwind tour for me. After the summit, I'll be heading to South Africa for the Cape Town and Johannesburg Spring One Tour editions, and then it's off to a developer event in Mauritius. Then it's off to the IT Connect event in Serbia. And then, finally, it's off to Hangzhou, China, where I'll be hanging out with our friends from Alibaba. All of this is exciting for me, and I'm so looking forward to seeing you all at those shows. I also recently put out two different Spring Tip installments that might be worth your time. They weren't planned. They were just sort of hot take reactions to some very interesting developments in the community, but I think you'll find them quite interesting. One looks at using the R2DBC integration for MySQL, powered by the third-party community project JawSync SQL. The other Spring Tip installment looks at using Spring Boot 2.2's pronounced speed gains. In that video, I show you how to go fast and be lazy and demonstrate building Spring Boot applications that start up in well under a second. They also reload using the DevTools in well under a third of a second. That's fast. Fast enough, certainly, that you won't notice anything between recompiling and refreshing the browser page. These videos, and of course dozens of others, are as always available at bit.ly/spring-tips-playlist. I'm excited about today's episode featuring OpenStack founder and former Pivotal Field CTO Josh McKenty. Josh, or better Josh, as I affectionately refer to him, is a brilliant mind and someone with whom I had the privilege of recording a Cloud Foundry Live Lessons video. The Live Lessons videos are masterclasses for a given topic and a great exhibition of the insight that someone like Josh can bring to the table. Our Live Lessons videos were more than 5 hours long, and it's a great demonstration of the kind of depth that somebody like him has in technologies like Cloud Foundry and the cloud in general. What a mind. What a guy. Josh and I plumbed the depths of Cloud Foundry, laughed and learned a lot. And then this episode was recorded just after Josh had left Pivotal for, well, perhaps maybe not greener, certainly different pastures. It's a look at data sovereignty, something which Josh is very familiar and passionately involved in. And it's a sort of exit interview with one of the finest technologists in the business and one that I hope you enjoy listening to as much as I enjoyed recording it. Hello, Josh. Can you hear me?
Yes, very well. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for joining a beautiful podcast. You are Josh McKenty. Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself besides that?
I am a uneducated generalist. I've worked on open source in general and infrastructure software in particular for the last decade. Before that, I was doing other open sourcey things, both on the nonprofit side and for various startups and big companies.
Now, already, I don't normally argue with my guests, but I'm going to argue with you. First of all, I could say I do general infrastructure code. That's not the same as what you do. That's not even the same ballpark, right? When you say you did infrastructure code, you mean you literally, I mean, I would never call like OpenStack just infrastructure code, right? I would never call all the work you did on Cloud Foundry and Kubernetes just infrastructure code, right? I would argue that that's the infrastructure, you know, the infrastructure, capital T-H-E, you know?
Well, fair enough. But remember, I'm best at the beginnings of things. So when we started what at the time was called NASA Nebula, which later became some big chunks of OpenStack, we were really just trying to solve a problem for a government agency, which was how do we build and host web applications that don't live deep inside NASA's infrastructure because they have to be connected to the public internet in a time when NASA was not allowed to use public cloud.
So anybody else, I would, you know, anybody else, I would call that name dropping. But you just mentioned NASA, and that's not even the most important part of the story. That's what's so interesting about you. It's like, it's just, it happens to be NASA, but that's not even the most interesting bit. Anyway, carry on.
NASA was a beautiful and fun and terrifying bureaucracy to be a part of for a window of time. yeah. So the, you know, we didn't know that OpenStack was going to be a big deal. We didn't know that it was going to become this sort of capital I infrastructure. And I think that same was true with Cloud Foundry when I first got involved with that, working with James Waters. It just seemed like a good technology solution to the problem we had. These things are funny to me because, you know, when I worked on Netscape, we knew Netscape was a big deal. It was right. Like, oh my God, Netscape, that's like the definition of the internet. And yeah. So we sort of every day went to work in this state of awe that we got to work on this code base at all. And yet that was probably the least successful of these various things I worked on. You know, we were trying to bring it back from the dead and it mostly didn't work. It died again afterwards.
That kills me.
Well, we got it to some millions of users, but it really only lasted a few years. Whereas the OpenStack and Cloud Foundry things, I wasn't intimidated by them because I was like, oh, this is just some weird, obscure, like automation and orchestration framework. Probably no one will ever use it.
But infrastructure is forever.
Huh?
Infrastructure is forever. Like, yes. You know, there, as you know, people are still very, very, very widely using OpenStack. Yeah. I think that's kind of an interesting. It was a Nebula and you built this thing to solve this particular problem.
Yeah.
And what? How did you go from research project inside of NASA to this thing that has its own community, conferences, users, deployed infrastructure, and big deals at satellite companies like Pivotal?
I mean, at the time, I had joined NASA wanting to work on open source, and so that had been my initial deal with my boss, who was the CIO there, that I would, you know, whatever I was working on would be part of an open source community. And the logistics of that inside NASA were just painful, incredibly painful. And so the partnership with Rackspace that created OpenStack, and I mean, they picked the name, they had already arranged to have a conference and they really wanted to build a new community. And we needed to be part of some community that was outside NASA in order to contribute meaningfully to open source. So it was kind of this perfectly weird partnership. It's like when you see those couples and you're like, well, how does that work? But it works.
You realize that. So yeah. Rackspace had you partnered with them early on and they're the ones that took this.
Yeah. It already picked the name. Rick Clark and Jonathan Bryce and Lou Mormon and all these folks had already, and Jim Curry had pulled together this plan, Mark Collier and others, to launch an open source cloud project. But they had the name, they had the idea, they had the conference, but they didn't have any code yet. They had the storage side, but none of the compute side. And so we already had a bunch of code that was public on GitHub and I'd written a blog post about, but we had no community or no branding. We're just like, hey, we just wanted to make sure this was out in the open. And so Rackspace said, hey, we could join forces, bring your code. We'll bring our name. And this can be the Rackspace and NASA launch a thing together.
That's interesting. So did you somehow bump into somebody from Rackspace in the community? Like how does an official government bureaucracy like NASA, or do they just find the code in GitHub? Is that just
No, I mean, the backstory is ridiculous. Actually, Mark Shuttleworth saw the blog post, sent it to Rick Clark and Thierry Souche and said, hey, have you guys checked this one out yet? It's coming out of NASA. Maybe this would be good.
Mark Shuttleworth as an Ubuntu founder.
Yeah. Yeah. Canonical Ubuntu founder.
Multi-millionaire who's actually been in space. That one.
Yeah. That guy. He's also, I mean, he's sort of fond of NASA in a peripheral way because of his passion for going into space. Right. And Rackspace said, oh, we haven't talked to them yet. We'll reach out. They managed to reach out to the business development lead on my team. Who came to me and my boss with this idea. And I was like, that is the stupidest thing ever. Rackspace is a colo provider in Texas. Like, why would we partner with them? I was just a total jerk about it. I was like, I don't even want to take a meeting. I don't have time for this. We're writing code. And fortunately for all of us, my boss overrode me and he's like, no, we should totally do a partnership. This would be great. And so they came out to NASA Ames and we spent a day sort of, we looked at what they were doing and they looked at what we were doing. And we're like, this could come together really well. We picked the same language. We like the same network switches.
Language is?
Well, it was Python. It was all 100% Python.
Damn right. Love Python.
Damn Skippy. A great system language, especially in the days before Go, right?
Yeah.
So I think if we were doing this over again, probably we would have picked Go. But at the time, Python was the best there was for this sort of project.
The ultimate glue language, you know, take pieces that don't know about each other and make them work together.
Yes. A language where, you know, functional programming is a first class citizen as opposed to sort of the sorry stepchild.
Yep. Well, that's okay. So at this point, you've just happened. So you are at this point, some combination of skill and competence and luck, right? I mean, some of this is just luck. Some of this is just,
oh yeah.
Most you of woke it. Up and something went right that shouldn't have otherwise gone right. I can't like,
yeah,
I love hearing stories like this because it's amazing how much of this luck it takes to get something amazing, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was reading a thing by Naval on Twitter last night where he was talking about luck and the different ways you end up being lucky.
Yeah, I saw that.
You can wait for luck, which is what most people do. You can create your own luck by continually putting yourself in situations where you're ready to seize the moment or you're looking for the kind of luck that other people pass. So you're saying yes to things that other folks are saying no to.
Yeah.
You can try and get into the space where luck seems to happen. You know, people who are continuously lucky or they're just, you know, there's places right now where things are happening that are lucky. I've been working with a really interesting community around data and ethics and governance and custody. And most of this has just come together in the last couple of months out of a sequence of things that just look like luck.
Right.
But it's actually, these are people who are lucky over and over and over and over again.
And have you ever seen that Jim Carrey movie, Yes Man?
Yeah, exactly. Yes. When you say yes to things, you find yourself in these amazingly lucky scenarios.
Right. And I think, okay, so Steve Jobs said that the hardest part about creating a business wasn't, I'm paraphrasing, but he said the hardest part about creating a business wasn't finding new ideas. It was deciding on which ones to, you know, refine and focus, you know, which of the infinite multitude of ideas that are presented before you every minute, every day, which ideas you pursue, you know,
what does that yes do?
So on the one hand, he's basically advocating for saying no. Right. On the other hand, I do find if you say yes a lot, you know, interesting things tend to come of it as opposed to the alternative, which is you end up isolated and kind of bored, you know?
Yeah.
If you say no. So I don't know. Smart enough and skilled enough to say yes at the right times, it seems like.
Well, the trick, I say yes when I don't know what's going to happen, as opposed to only saying yes when I do know what's going to happen. I think that's a lot of people start from a position of risk of saying, well, I have to understand what this is going to look like and how it's going to play out before I can say yes.
Yeah.
I tend to do the reverse of like, if I don't know what is going to happen and how this is going to play out, maybe there's a lot of possibility in that. And so I'll say yes to the crazier things.
That helps me to understand that because I just say yes if somebody smarter than I am, like you, says yes. So I just follow the pack, you know. Oh, that's it. That's very. Now that I know that you're just like rolling the dice, and I am by proxy.
I'm rolling the dice towards, you know, what seems like I would learn something.
Right. Yeah.
The worst case. You know, the project is a failure, the team collapses, everyone goes bankrupt. But if you learned something, it was still positive.
Right. All things being equal, at least you made the brain a little bit bigger, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool. Okay, so now you're doing data, you're in this space where you're exploring data governance. Now, like, was there something in between Rackspace and before we get into the data governance, I still want to loose end, I want to tie up some threads here. That whole OpenStack thing, I don't think people, what is it? Let's just be, what does it do?
Oh, it powers a lot of clouds in the world, mostly private clouds, some service providers' environments, some public clouds. And by which I mean it is the orchestration software for managing virtual resources using physical resources.
And so does it look kind of, does it give you the API driven on demand kind of feel to private on-prem infrastructure as maybe an AWS gives you in that public cloud?
Absolutely.
Something like that.
You know, there are big organizations. I'm always careful to only talk about the ones that talk about themselves. So let's say, you know, Swisscom, Yahoo Japan, the Gap, BMW, these big companies run their own private clouds using OpenStack.
Right.
Some big telecommunications providers do for their own infrastructure, but also for their customers. And then there are a few public cloud providers that really, you know, mostly in the what I would think of the second and third tier providers use OpenStack as a commercial offering.
Well, that's interesting. So it came full circle. It was life imitating art, imitating life. You built OpenStack to provide kind of like not specifically AWS, but a thing kind of like that, right? And then now people are using it to provide their own AWS.
We sort of figured that would happen. And as the community coalesced, that was the first big use case. But it also went in just crazy other directions. You know, like CERN, the big Large Hadron Collider project, uses a ton of OpenStack, massive OpenStack environments there. And I was actually visiting them, talking with them about NASA Nebula before we launched it as OpenStack. And so they were kind of involved in that community from the very beginning. So we thought there would be these use cases where, for whatever reason, public cloud just makes no sense. You know, it's not big enough, it's not fast enough, it's not weird enough. At certain scales, in certain places, it's not secure enough, or it's not, you know, running on infrastructure owned by a government agency, for instance. So
you and I have both seen that some of these large customers, when they say cloud, they're not talking about AWS or GCP or Azure. They want that sort of dynamic self-serve on-demand model, but they're not trying to get rid of their data centers. That's not going away anytime soon, right? So,
And not being involved in OpenStack or anything related to it, I can look at it and say, well, some of what people are doing with this is actually a long-term good idea.
Yeah.
Some of it isn't. Some of it is sort of short-term thinking. Some of it is sunk cost fallacy, or saying, well, we've got to keep doing it the way we've always done it because that's what we've always done.
Right.
And so there's a mix, but that's true in every technical domain. You know, there's folks using public cloud for things that they really shouldn't. There are folks using containers or serverless for things that really just they shouldn't. Same thing happened with NoSQL. There's a lot of things that just should be in MySQL or Postgres that folks have gone off and put into some complicated JSON document object store.
So was your web scale document store, sir? Web scale.
Oh, yes.
Was your understanding of that fact, the fact that people do things with low level primitive infrastructure like OpenStack, and sometimes abuse low level primitive infrastructure like OpenStack, was that kind of what led you to, like, how did Pivotal nab you at one point? Like, what?
James Waters and I have been friends for ages. You know, he used to come before it was OpenStack, when it was NASA Nebula, he came to some of my public talks and heckled.
Right.
always fun. And
when you start James Waters, that is, Pivotal SVP.
Yeah.
GOAT, right?
You know, part of the original Cloud Foundry founding team.
Right.
He and I had partnered between VMware and my company at the time, Piston, had partnered to make Cloud Foundry run well on OpenStack. Mm-hmm. And that had been a key go-to-market motion for Piston. We were out there selling OpenStack as a great way to run Cloud Foundry. And we had some good early joint customers with Pivotal. And so when I was looking to do kind of the next thing, this was just a supernatural transition. And then the other half is when I was hired at NASA, my original job was to build a platform as a service. That's what we were trying to do. We only built OpenStack because we weren't allowed to use infrastructure as a service that was public, and we needed something to put our pads on top of.
Oh, well, really? OpenStack was like the first step.
Yeah, I never wanted to build infrastructure. I wanted to build a platform. I've been fascinated by, as I think every sort of software architect or long-term software engineer is, you get obsessed with the runtime environment for your applications and how can you tweak that to make it easier to write code and run it and iterate more quickly. And
right.
Less and less about, you know, the scaling concerns and the load balancing and HA concerns, all of these things where you get pulled away from the value you're trying to deliver and into the nitty gritty, the sort of boring details.
Wow. Okay, so did that ever get done anywhere, or like after you left NASA, did they eventually build a platform? Or
no, actually, after I left NASA, they figured out how to change a lot of regulation. Well, one of the last things I did when I was at NASA, I was an advisor to my boss, who was on the committee that was forming FedRAMP. Right, so this was the new push of how do we change government regulation to allow government agencies to take advantage of public cloud.
Okay,
and so that passed, and NASA kind of changed a lot of their own regulations to allow them to go use AWS and Azure and Google, and that really was what they wanted to do anyway. It's what I had wanted to do when I was there. I just don't have the patience, or I didn't have the patience at the time, for fixing problems through regulation.
Right.
I wanted to fix problems through writing code, you know.
And that's a long slog, yeah.
Yeah, it's the engineer's approach of, I can solve this problem right now with, you know, 6,000 lines of Python, instead of a couple of years of arguing with lawyers. But the nice thing about somebody arguing with lawyers is that's the long-term fix.
Right.
It was really the short-term fix. But short-term in this case was, you know, 5 years.
Yeah. There's a in the Java community, there's a gentleman named Terrence Parr, who's a professor of computer science, I think at Berkeley maybe, and he wrote this grammar, you know, parser combinator parser generator combination thing called Antler. And Antler, you know, it gives you Bison like, it's a Bison like grammar parser, He wrote it because at one point he was writing a recursive descent parser for a language, and he was doing it by hand. And he said, "This is ridiculous. I can automate this."
Yeah.
And so he said, "What would have been a couple of hours worth of work ended up becoming 10 years of work." And he says, "Why write by hand in 1 hour what you can write, you know, with automation in 10 years?" You know.
Totally. I had a guy used to work with at Mercurial, and we had asked him to build, you know, kind of a plug-in framework for enterprise antivirus, I think, at the time. And he had a similar experience. He got frustrated. Was like, why would I solve this specific case of like a little plug-in scripting thing when I could write a Turing complete language? We came back 6 weeks later, and he's like, okay, I've got the lexer and the parser done, and it compiles. And but we're like, what have you done? He's like, but look at how perfect it is for this use case. So programmers are often guilty of this experience. You know, we've all had experiences.
It's funny if you're not the one doing it, you know, and we all are at some point, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, totally. All right. So you landed at Pivotal. Did this Cloud Foundry thing ever take off? Like what did it do? It did.
And it's been, it's a little bit like OpenStack was in those first few years. People don't even realize now how big it is and how, you know, there are single users that have tens of thousands of containers in Cloud Foundry in production that have been there for years, that run, you know, entire businesses, entire companies. But it's boring because the success story is the applications on top, always, right? The success story is, what is this empowering? And it also exists in a time where infrastructure has gotten very frothy. This is the thing. Yeah. The problem with infrastructure being cool again is that infrastructure is cool again.
Right.
So now everyone's talking about it all the time, which means they want to write new coolness. So the move is constantly to use new kinds of primitives, you know, oh, well, we should do everything in functions. We should do everything in a service mesh. We should do everything in, you know, and I saw a joke again on Twitter this morning. Somebody's like, in the future, you know, all IO is network IO and all network IO is HTTP and all HTTP is on port 403.
That was Dave Cheney, right? The
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah.
Yeah, I think. Love that guy.
I think
what was interesting for me was that you and I would bump into each other.
Yeah.
In our as we circulated the globe talking to customers for Pivotal and without knowing that I would bump into you, not knowing that you'd be in the same region for a completely different team at the organization, right? Yep. And I would be there on behalf of the developers working in Spring, and you'd be there in terms of like the you know infrastructure, right? The actual how do I make anything that these crazy developers do work?
Yeah,
you know that team, right? Yep. So, and it was very interesting that these companies would be so the uptake for something like CloudFront would be so big that there could be different teams from Pivotal on site at the same time, not even know that we're there because there's so much happening, you know?
And I was always jealous of your role in that world because you got to talk to the developers building the applications. You were back in the world that I came from that I
right.
miss. You know, honestly, all of this infrastructure and all of this platform automation and everything that's happening in orchestration is about making the teams that you work with productive, allowing them to focus on just building the code that matters. But it's right. not the code that matters. And so I'm like down in the trenches of infrastructure going, oh, Josh Long gets to talk about applications. That's unfair.
You were interesting. I think you're being modest. Most of the time I would see you because again, who controls the purse strings, right? It wasn't the developer. You would be talking to the executive.
Yeah.
Well, part of the organization, the people that are willing to go in on the strategy, which is Cloud Foundry, right? The people that are doing, and that requires a lot of that requires an understanding of the benefits of such a strategy, the nuances of which you are infinitely more qualified to articulate.
I've been a CEO, you know, and a CTO and a senior executive. And so it's easier for me to look at the value of the apps you're building and the value of a simple platform to run them from a business perspective. Hey, you need to be able to update these applications every week or every day and not once a quarter or once a year. And you know, you can make that be a burden of every app team building their own way of doing that, which to a certain extent is what the early DevOps movement was.
Yeah.
Or you can make that an organizational standard, which is really what the platform movement was. And that tension exists as we go forward. And whether it's serverless or it's Kubernetes or it's service mesh, we always have this. Are you going to let every dev team do it their own way? Or are you going to have a standard that's the 90% solution? And then you're going to let people go above and beyond that in certain ways. That is
by providing primitives that are composable.
Yeah. Yeah. And composable at what layer of abstraction? Because going back to like what's happening on the network, what impact does that have on performance? What impact does that have on shared infrastructure? What about noisy neighbors? What about auth? What about where's the data and who's auditing whose data it is, which kind of takes me forward to where I'm going now. But these are
what you just described is exactly why I like Pivotal, because now the debate, you said there's a tension and you're right. The tension is about we can have a discussion about where we should solve a particular problem in the stack, but wherever that stack, wherever you are in that stack, you're still using, it's either a Spring or a Cloud Foundry or a Bosch or, you know, we have all those pieces. So we can have it because these things are, there's a sort of virtuous feedback between all these different components. We move up and down the stack and have debates about where we should solve particular problems, but it's nice that it's all one tool set.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. The thing we talk about all the time is how quickly things are changing.
Yeah. And
partly that's in technology and partly that's business demands and the speed, the rate of change overall as these changes add up and combine in really meaningful ways.
Right.
We're entering a period now where I think the delayed consequences of a lot of the decisions of the last 25 years are catching up on us. And we're going to start seeing that same rapid change in policy and regulation and rules, really, around what kind of ethics are required in technology. What does it mean to have consent from your users? It's not going to just be a simple click wrap. You know, you can't just say, oh, I gave you all of my rights to all of the information you could ever gather about me to do whatever you want with by clicking a button when I was trying to install an app.
So do you imagine a future where data has this sort of built-in provenance trail?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we start seeing data and metadata and other forms of metadata. I was sort of mulling over what would it be to call it lien data, L-I-E-N, in terms of a chain of liabilities or a chain of responsibilities attached to the data, as well as data about it. It's data about its ownership and its license and its provenance. And if you look at what we can do with perfect forward secrecy or with differential privacy, we have the technology now to say, I want to give you access to this data for a period of time for a set of uses, and that's it. I do not give you permission to do more than that.
Is that not – so linking that back to politics, that makes me think about GDPR.
Yes, absolutely. GDPR is the first stab at this, and I think it's a good stab, and there are some important characteristics. It's multinational, right?
Yeah.
These problems are data does not respect borders.
Right. No, absolutely. It's an open
regulation that is grappling with data custody cannot respect borders. But it's also not enough. It's not anywhere near enough because it doesn't really deal with some of the fundamental model problems of saying we are still thinking about data as if it's property and has ownership and has license. And that's true of some data, but it's really not true of all data. Some data really is kind of should be human rights governed. You know, I can't change my biometrics. I can't change my fingerprints. So the data of my fingerprints has to be treated not as property, but as actually kind of intrinsically like a human right. And then there are other data like derived data products and combined data products and correlation where it has an impact on all of society. If we think about the way DNA data is being traded around very casually now, my children and their children, and in fact, my entire family are impacted by the sharing of DNA data that maybe I gave permission for, but they didn't. And yet it's 96, 97, whatever percent the same. The sort of correlation that pops out of these data sets, and what we've tried to do generally is control this at the point of use or at the point of access instead of at the point of capture.
Right. You mean the capture value out of the data?
Capture mean actually save and store the data. So,
but isn't that the same as the point of access? Like the point of
access is when it's coming out of those data systems. So let's say there's a bunch of cameras all over London and they're taking photos of everyone who walks everywhere.
Right.
That's the moment of capture, which is really unregulated. Yeah. Now we're saying, who's allowed to do what with facial recognition? And how much of that can be combined with financial records or what that these are all questions of use and access, but we've kind of ignored. And GDPR took a stab of saying, here's a right for removal. That's being fought in court now of companies saying, well, your right is to remove it from results, which is essentially saying use, not from the actual underlying data store or from the effect it had on the models we built out of that data and the way we combine with other data sets. So there are huge, interesting problems that are society shaping problems, not just the economics of how this data is being used and who's benefiting, but the impact to, what is the insurance? What does the medical insurance industry look like if we acknowledge that every single person in the world has a pre-existing condition, which is what we're doing when we say we have your DNA.
Yeah. And this also the opposite of like there's GDPR, which I think is a very big hammer for like, it seems a little blunt an instrument, but I guess I prefer we swing a little too far in that direction than not, you know, so I'm glad we did, but it has no subtlety, right? It's just very much a sort of like you said, there's still questions about whether it's actually removed from the underlying data store. There's, you know, there's some issues that make me think that this policy was drafted ignorant of technology.
Yeah.
But I prefer that approach to, for example, what's happening in China, where you just raised the harrowing specter of the combination of facial recognition data and synthesized models based on feeds of data coming into to a big brain about your credit score, your online activity, all these things kind of congeal to form a social credit score, right? In China.
I mean, anyone who's seen Minority Report and gets over the acting or the dialogue will get this fundamental idea of our ability to prejudge people as being either criminals or capable of becoming criminals and therefore treat them that way. We already do this at a massive scale. That's what credit reporting is. But it's increasingly class-based and race-based and gender-based, and it's institutionalized bias. My friend Johnny Penn wrote an article for The Economist about the fact that AI was originally built to automate bureaucracy, not to automate intelligence. It's not artificial intelligence, it's artificial bureaucracy. And bureaucracy is as guilty or more guilty than anything else of these kinds of prejudices and biases.
Well, there's systemic biases. That's exactly what you encode into a system. Is these
absolutely the system itself, and it's both within the system in terms of the algorithms, and also how the system is structured in terms of whose data gets captured and used, and who has an army of lawyers who can read the terms of service and decide whether or not to click on them. So you know we have a bunch of projects on the go. Some of these are about, to your point, educating the policymakers, helping them understand with simple but accurate metaphors, what are these underlying challenges and why are some of these short-term fixes not actually going to help? And there's actually prefiguratives. So what would an alternative look like? What would actually be good for society? What do we want that future state to look like and why?
Is there any place in the world where they're doing it well, where they're grappling with this problem in a way that
But there are pieces of good solutions in many places. There's some interesting work going on with labor unions to say maybe the unions themselves can be an instrument of collective bargaining around data rights. There are experiments with data commons and data trusts in terms of, hey, what if we trust a third party to hold the data? And then the company that wants to profit off of it, or the agency that wants to use it in some way, has controlled access, has access based on consent, as opposed to, well, in theory there was consent in the past, in practice there's no consent for ongoing use. So there are examples of these. You know, New Zealand is doing some interesting things. Singapore is doing some interesting things. Switzerland is doing some interesting things. There are academic institutions with a ton of researchers who are thinking through this. There isn't as much yet focus on making this a open public dialogue by making it simple enough to talk about.
Or policy.
Yeah.
Simple enough to encode as policy.
Well, there's a lot of folks working on policy, and unfortunately they're working on it in terms of response to point solutions or point problems and not a holistic picture. So there's three or four states that have draft policy going now around privacy legislation, California being one of those. This will be really problematic if this is the solution we end up with. One, because a fractured regulatory environment. We need a polycentric environment. So we need layers of regulation that are somewhat independent, as opposed to lots of regulation that's parallel but also highly dependent, which becomes a nightmare for anyone to operate in, either the individual or the company.
Because then every discussion becomes, what does this impact locally? And then what is the interplay with other regions and other intersections?
And when you need to do the sort of more drastic but necessary things, like classify certain types of data as human rights law instead of property law, you can't do that at a local level. And it's hard to do at a national level when the local level has already done something different.
And especially when you've got free movement, as you do in Europe and the United States, it becomes moot, right?
Like, yeah, exactly. Data crosses borders faster than people.
You and I both know how we move across borders, so why wouldn't the data that follows us?
Yeah. So, and then there's also some interesting experiments happening in terms of what would professional ethics look like in terms of data users. So we think about the Hippocratic Oath and how it applies to doctors. And we say we can't employ somebody as a doctor unless they're actually a member of that profession, which means active membership in an organization that governs their behavior separate from their employer. If we applied the same structure to data scientists, we would have revolution in places like Facebook, where the folks on the ground, knowing they would lose their license to manipulate data if they were doing the things that Facebook pays them to do, would just say, well, I can now afford to say no because I know that Facebook can't hire someone else who will say yes. And that's
that gets back to the idea of a union,
exactly. Beyond a union, it's actually the definition of this as a profession with professional ethics. Then right. The collective bargaining can come into play. But actually, it doesn't really matter what Facebook wants to agree to or would agree to. What matters is what the people on the ground doing that job know they can say yes or no to, based on a larger organization supporting them, so they don't feel alone.
Now, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg testified in Congress maybe a month ago, end of 2018, and he did his normal kowtow and apologized to her. But one thing I thought was kind of interesting was that he seemed pretty. I guess it was Q4, maybe Q3, 2018. It wasn't that long ago, but he seemed to embrace the onslaught of regulation. I'm not sure if this is just a mouth, what he's saying versus what he's doing, but he seemed to welcome the idea that there is going to have to be a regulatory framework in which Facebook resides, mm-hmm. To be able to satisfy the hordes of people who are concerned about the misuse of their data.
There's probably three or four things going on. Here's my take on that. The first one is he's probably lying most of the time.
Yeah.
But even if we assume that he's telling the truth, Facebook would want it to be regulation as opposed to a call for them to self-regulate, because regulation will slow down their competitors equally. So in that sense, national regulation or international regulation is a level playing field. So if things get harder for them, they know it's getting harder for everyone else.
And that's the money.
And the third thing pragmatically is regulation takes a long time. So if he agrees to a path that eventually 5 years from now limits in minute ways, he also knows that during that period of time, he has an army of lobbyists who are going to shrink the impact of that regulation to almost nothing.
So he can have a hand in shaping such regulation, so we agree he is acting on good faith that at some point ineluctably there will be regulation that governs how Facebook goes. What he's trying to do now is control that regulation.
Yeah. And regulation is never going to be enough. That's why I didn't start with I just want to do policy. I started with, I want to have global impact. What does that look like? Okay, well, some of that will be policy. Some of that will be memes. Some of that will be organizing or evangelism or collective bargaining or curriculum for different universities or, technical systems for how can this be done better? What does data, metadata, and lean data in one file format look like? Just as a thought experiment, what does a data browser look like as a thought experiment? All of these pieces, and by the way, lots of these ideas are not mine. So I feel like I should give the bibliography of the 20 people I'm stealing ideas from. I'll name a couple. Tony Lai at Stanford and Johnny Penn, who I mentioned earlier at Cambridge, and Anouk in Newspeak House, Jesse K. Schindler, who's formerly at NASA, and Andrew Hoppin, who's a Edmund Hillary Fellow, and also the CEO of CoverUs. These are so many people are thinking about this problem space right now, I think I have a megaphone and I'm going to pass the megaphone around.
Right on. And so that is your sort of area of focus nowadays?
Yeah. I mean, that I am extraordinarily lucky. We were talking about luck earlier, having started four companies, sold two of them, survived an IPO, and also done some time at government. I have two kids and I'm a full-time parent. I need to be able to stay home with my kids. And this is a thing that I can do, from my laptop, which feels pretty, pretty powerful.
Yeah. And what city's skyline is outside of your window now?
It's Victoria. And I'm fond of pumping Victoria and the fact that it kicked Paris off the Condé Nast list for the top 10 best cities in the world. But it snowed last night, which is not typical for us for this time of year. We've had no snow this winter, and it's windy. And down the street at my my daughter's house or her mom's house, the power is out. So kind of a funny time of year in Victoria. But usually, honestly, this time of year in Victoria is like tulips are coming up and the birds are singing and it's beautiful.
Right. I thought, you know, we saw we're supposed to have more spring. I saw the groundhog in the East Coast. He or she came out and saw his or her own shadow. So I thought that was, we're going to have spring more, is it the other way around? Maybe it's more winter. I don't know. Either way, the weather doesn't seem to line up with what the groundhog was saying was going to happen. That's my complaint. If I could register that with you,
yes.
Maybe you can do something about the weather. I don't know. It's maybe it's beyond your skill set, but it's pouring rain here in San Francisco. So
I've never done much with weather modeling. I've done, you know, earthquake modeling and social network modeling, but never weather. It intimidates me.
Well, you're actually doing something a little bit even more heady. These ideas around data. How do you model? Our old friend Dave McCrory talked about data gravity, yeah. Right? This idea that there's an accrual of data, that a source of data then pulls other data into it. And so now you've got this really sort of combinatorial effect where data becomes bigger and bigger the more you've got it registered. So Facebook, for example, will forever have an ecosystem around it that's building data. So whatever policy you work on would regulate not just Facebook, but the ecosystem of feeder applications, analysts, and analytics that are happening beyond Facebook, right? We heard about it came out recently that there were some companies that had a direct fire hose, source to that data from Facebook, but a lot of them are just, as you know, through an OAuth authorization.
Yeah. I mean, when I was at Tapulous briefly, I was there for the iPhone launch, and I was also there during the early days of the Facebook developer platform. The notion that Facebook wanted to experiment with sharing the social graph and making it available for people to build applications on had that kind of classic, beautiful Silicon Valley naivete of like, well, what could possibly go wrong? It turns out a lot can go wrong. And
developer manifest destiny is weird.
Yes, it is. We could have seen this coming, should have seen this coming. People did. Science fiction writers did, but it's really hard for society to respond to things that haven't happened yet. So the threat in the abstract is not motivation. It's now that we can say, oh, hey, look, this is what happens when your psychological weakness is exploited by a third party, which is why I think we can start treating this kind of data as if it was health data, because your ability to be influenced and manipulated is a pre-existing condition. It's a psychological weakness. Giving up that information should require informed consent.
And you make a great point. We should treat that data as health data, but there's a second implied part, which I don't think is so well understood in certain corners of the planet, namely where I'm in right now in the United States, which is that health data should be very, very private, and that there should be a substantial amount of walled sort of protection around that. And it should be easy to conduct and communicate, as opposed to being this siloed thing that is useless to most doctors, that has to be reproduced every time you go to a new doctor.
Yeah. Well, here's the funny thing about healthcare. If I go into the hospital and they're going to cut off my leg, they have to explain to me why. They have to get my consent. They have to get my informed consent, which means they have to prove they explained it to me in a way that I understood, that I understand the risks, that I understand I will never have a leg again afterwards. They're not going to be able to sew it back on. And that I have to continue to give consent for further procedures. And there are very strict rules about when they can do something without my consent and whose consent they need. The data that exposes me to a similar level of risk as if it was a medical procedure has no such controls over it. And that's really what Facebook is wielding here as Google and others, this idea that data is harmless, or it's just for getting value out of, or it's my responsibility to somehow be immune to the manipulation that this data exposes me to. And right. I think what this comes down to is this old belief, nobody clicks on ads. And if you click on ads, it's on you. And the entire right. advertising and marketing industry is built around this dichotomy between, on the one hand, we know that we can manipulate the populace. And on the other hand, we pretend that it's not us getting manipulated. And we don't right. treat it as a societal concern of whether or not people are manipulated in these ways. It's sort of a fascinating, you know, fake belief we have about ourselves being superhuman in a way that we're not.
Yeah, and that's not good. I mean, that leads to, if anything, when dealing with something so big, maybe a little humility would be better. All right, my friend. Do you? We've got, let's say, a few more minutes before we have to wind down, because, as you know, I've got to run. First of all, where can people find more of you on the intertubes? Yeah. Speaking of access to data.
That's a great question. I was trying to solve this last night, actually, knowing I was going to be on your podcast. Right now, the collaboration I have is all, you know, in shared Google Docs and WhatsApp chats and a little bit on some GitHub issues. And we've been really trying to figure out where do we go as a team in terms of publishing and collaboration. And one of the principles I wanted to embrace is kind of, we should do things with our data that are prefigurative of the things we're saying everyone should do. So I wanted to go try out IPFS. So I took the introduction to this idea of data custody that we'd written up, and I published it on IPFS last night. And this morning I was struggling with DNS link and the way that you actually make immutable content easy to find, so that I would be able to update that draft instead of just sharing a hash. In the meantime, people should just find me on Twitter, right? That's what folks are doing. That's what they've done for, I think the 50,000th user on Twitter. I'm probably never going to leave Twitter, which is sort of embarrassing because it is a cesspool, but it's also a beautiful cesspool.
Right. It is a beautiful cesspool. Right. What is your Twitter handle?
At J McKenty, JMCKENTY. And will be forever.
All right. And there, of course, more people can find you, and you will have information about where they can read more as it becomes available.
Absolutely. I'll be posting IPFS hashes to my Twitter handle from now on.
All righty, my friend. That's amazing. I look forward to seeing you on the internet and around the world. And thanks so much for joining us today. I hope you
are. Josh, I really, really appreciated you having me on. And as always, better Josh. It's always a pleasure.
No, you're the better Josh.
Thank you. Yeah.
Miss you, my friend. I'll talk to you soon. Bye. Thanks again. A Bootiful podcast is produced by me, Josh Long. I do these podcasts because I believe that everything we do in software is for and made better by people. I want to hear from you. I'm Josh at joshlong.com by email, or at STARBUXMAN on Twitter, where, of course, my direct messages are wide open. Do you have guest ideas, topic suggestions, feedback? Don't hesitate to reach out. If you like the show, then please consider rating it on iTunes and leaving a review, as it really helps the show. I sampled music from Steve Combs' Them from Morning and Springtime and Steve Combs' Small Victory, both of which are licensed under a Creative Commons license. I'm trying to hire production assistants to make the production of this podcast easier. I want to make sure that we can add things like show notes and transcripts and just generally do more. If you would like to advertise on the show, then please reach out to me. And if you can't or don't want to advertise but would like to otherwise support the show, then please consider supporting me at patreon.com, patreon.com/Josh Long, for as low as $4 a month. Thanks again. No harm came to any seasons in the making of this podcast.